You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Along with Noah's Ark and the Christmas stories, the story of David and Goliath is probably one of the most familiar stories from the Bible. Virtually every child learns it in its most simple form. And just the title, David and Goliath, has entered our cultural lexicon as shorthand for whenever the smaller and weaker prevails against the larger and stronger, or the unlikely hero turns the tide of conflict for an entire people. In reality, we think we know the story so well that we actually know very little of it at all. The antagonists, who themselves have ended up in our cultural lexicon representing the unclean masses, are the Philistines. Somewhere near the end of the Bronze Age, it appears that successive droughts and food shortages led to this massive migration all around the Mediterranean. So this people, who we don't know much about from the archaeological record, but have come to be called the Philistines, appear to have arrived in Canaan with a reputation for upending whole civilizations. Hebrew scripture is awash with conflict between the Israelites and the Philistines, and the biblical authors seem to indulge in their fair share of exaggeration in order to emphasize just how evil they truly were. For example, the Bible got our story today from ancient texts that are about 1,500 years old. In those texts, the authors put Goliath's height at about 9 feet tall. But guess what? When the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, they included a copy of the Book of Samuel that is 1,000 years older than the text from which we get our Bible. This much older text pegs Goliath at 6 feet 9 inches. So, obviously over the years, successive storytellers amped up Goliath to make him even more scary. It's this kind of detail and the conflicting order of events that put this story, like our other biblical stories, into the category of parable or fable. Case in point is in the chapter right before this story. Saul is going mad, and his chief of staff suggests that music will soothe his frazzled mind. And hey, there's this shepherd kid I know who plays a mean harp. Well, Saul loves David and basically adopts him, not knowing, ironically, that the prophet Samuel has already anointed David to take Saul's place. So, David is actually a part of the king's household. Okay, that's timeline number one. Then comes the Goliath incident, and Saul clearly doesn't have any idea who this kid from the sticks is. So, what we have here is clear evidence of two different traditions about David being stuck together. Even though the stories don't fit, and anyone doing a screenplay would need to deal with some major continuity problems. We're going to join the story already in progress at the moment when King Saul is so desperate that he agrees to send a lone shepherd boy who he's just met into battle with the enemy's best infantryman. In a feeble kind of CYA gesture, Saul totally immobilizes David by piling his own armor on the poor kid. When David heads out to face this fearsome foe, pay careful attention to the conversation he has with Goliath before their physical confrontation. The whole point of the story is not just that David fells the giant, we're not even going to read that part, but that he is operating with a sense of Yahweh-inspired confidence that shames his fellow Israelites into action. There's a lot more to it than just the ultimate underdog story.
Our words of wisdom today are from 1 Samuel 17, verses 38 to 48. Then Saul outfitted David as a soldier in armor. He put his bronze helmet on his head and belted his sword on him over the armor. David tried to walk, but he could hardly budge. David told Saul,
"I can't even move with all this stuff on me. I'm not used to this."
And he took it all off. Then he took his shepherd's staff, selected 5 smooth stones from the brook, and put them in the pocket of his shepherd's pack, and with his sling in his hand approached Goliath. As the Philistine paced back and forth, his shield bearer in front of him, he noticed David. He took one look down on him and sneered, "A mere youngster, apple-cheeked and peach-fuzzed." The Philistine ridiculed David.
"Am I a dog that you come after me with a stick?"
And he cursed him by his gods.
"Come on, I'll make roadkill of you for the buzzards. I'll turn you into a tasty morsel for the field mice."
"You come at me with sword and spear and battle axe. I come at you in the name of God of the angel armies, the God of Israel's troops, whom you curse and mock. This very day, God is handing you over to me. I'm about to kill you, cut off your head, and usurp your body and the bodies of your Philistine buddies to the crows and coyotes. The whole earth will know that there's an extraordinary God in Israel, and everyone gathered here will learn that God doesn't save by means of sword or spear. The battle belongs to God. He's handing you to us on a platter."
That roused the Philistine, and he started toward David. David took off from the front line, running toward the Philistine. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Once upon a time, a psychology professor with a reputation for messing with his students' minds and for giving long, complicated tests, gave his students a final exam of only one question. At first, they all looked relieved, but as the difficulty of the question began to sink in, many became confused and anxious, all except one student. He read the question, tapped his pencil into his palm a few times, and then jotted something down on the test paper. He walked up to the professor, handed him the final, and walked out. The professor blinked in surprise, looked at what the student wrote, and smiled. The professor wrote 100% on the top of that student's test. The question? What is courage? The answer from the student? This is. If only all of us could be so clever and confident. In his book, A Pretty Good Person, Lewis Smedes muses about when being pretty good is all we can muster, and that pretty good is pretty okay. In it, he tells the story of Ruby Bridges. Ruby could have stayed home. She didn't have to go to school. And every one of the cowards who heckled and threatened her could have walked away from the crowd and come to Ruby's side. Could have if they had willed to do it. But courage can be an elusive trait in we humans. Some of you might remember Ruby. She was the little black girl who integrated the New Orleans schools in 1960. If you don't remember her from these pictures, maybe Norman Rockwell will help. A white school teacher described what she saw when Ruby walked into school. A woman spat at Ruby, but missed. Ruby smiled at her. A man shook his fist at her. Ruby smiled at him. Then she walked up the stairs, and she stopped and turned and smiled one more time. And you know what she told one of those marshals? She told him she prays for those people, the ones in the mob, every night before she goes to sleep. In fact, Ruby said she prayed all the way to school for the strength to do what she did. Did Ruby do it alone? No. As it turns out, it was all very strategic. The local NAACP canvassed the black community to find a family who was willing to help integrate the New Orleans school system. Ruby's parents answered that call, and with Ruby's consent, volunteered their six-year-old. Now, psychiatrists and sociologists have analyzed children like Ruby to see if there was a psychiatric explanation for their remarkable behavior. Dr. Robert Coles concluded, "I think it starts with the religious tradition in black families. In home after home, I've seen Jesus' teachings, Jesus' life, connected to the lives of black children by their parents, connecting with the child's sense of what is important." Connecting with what's important. That's what Ruby's story is about. And being connected to what's important is what gave her the courage to do what she did. Lewis Meads writes, "Courage is generated in that recess of the spirit we poetically call the heart. Even the word courage itself comes from the old French courage, the Latin root of which is cor, or heart. It's where we get the word coronary." Smeads writes, "It is a power that surges from the heart to our wills, leads us beyond thinking and talking, and pushes us to do the right thing when we're terribly afraid that doing it could cost us more than we want to pay." Is it an instinct? Yeah. Part of our primal past? Yes. Is it born of conviction? Absolutely. Is it inspired by religious thought? "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me." All these things combined to give Ruby the heart to do what she did. But her heart needed feet. Courage comes alive in actions. Courage can be expressed in a lot of different ways. Living for a good cause, dying for a good cause, saying no to compromise or saying yes to compromise, by throwing off your burden or bearing your burden. In fact, there are really two forms of courage: acting in the face of deadly danger, volunteers for the one-way trip to Mars, government whistleblowers exposing corruption, breaking up a fight at a Texas gas station, a child taking a second trip to the dentist. Guts, valor, fortitude, we risk dying, or it seems that way. Or acting well when troubles are already upon us. Just hanging on to life, enduring daily what others can't imagine, a kind of courage that deals with the chronic and very real challenges of life. Like our story today, the Bible is full of stories of courage. Ordinary, small people doing courageous things. And the more we teach and tell these stories, the more likely the virtue of courage will surface in us when the time is right. If we lived in a world where the people who did the right thing always got the prize, nobody would need courage. If we lived in a paradise where nothing ever threatened us, we wouldn't need courage. But in the real world, we need courage because pain, loss, and death are real. but we need preparation. We need to decide ahead of time that doing right is more important than what we may lose by doing it. Have you decided that your health is important? Then there's courage, even in the simple act of going to the doctor. Fear says, don't go. You may get bad news. Courage says, go ahead. If you're sick, the doctor is the one who'll know what to do. It takes courage just to pick up the phone, to call the person with whom you have a disagreement. For some, it takes courage just to get out of bed and face the overwhelming challenges of yet another day. It takes courage to be vulnerable and honest with those who could reject you. We all have moments for courage, sooner or later. Will we do the right thing? No one can decide for us. We have to do it ourselves. But even though we have to make that decision for ourselves, we really don't have to be alone. Real courage grows out of community, commitment to and with others. When you trust in your community or family to not reject you, you trust that others will not let you down when crisis or challenges come. When others are depending on you, we're often inspired to actions which are seen as courageous. I don't know about you, but more often than not, the story of David and Goliath seems to be wasted on shallow platitudes about victory. The story about the little guy beating the big guy. God brings us the victory. But that ignores the part that we've read today, where David is confronted by his challenge, and we can see him actually working up the courage to go through with it. When you consider whether or not you are courageous, what kinds of situations come to mind? Facing down armed villains? Risking your own safety to rescue someone who is hurt or stranded? Standing up to overwhelmingly evil forces of hate and injustice? Look, if you manage to live your whole life without ever pulling someone from a burning building, or standing up to a gang of thugs, or vanquishing an evil empire, have you failed to nurture courage as a virtue in your life? The Apostle Paul celebrates the courage of those who are simply able to endure what life throws at them. Hardship, vilification, rejection, pain and suffering, even death. In fact, in much of Paul's correspondence, he celebrates being able to rejoice in suffering. What kind of crazy person does that? One who knows that every day brings to each of us the challenges that help us hone our courage. And when we have the support and encouragement of a community around us, we are strengthened all the more. But the story of David and Goliath is actually kind of unhelpful, I think, in the real world. In the real world, people who are doing God's work often end up, by the world's measure, losing. I think most of you know of my respect for the witness of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He was that German pastor who saw the Nazis for who they were and organized to resist them. They arrested him and put him in prison. There he wrote this prayer: "Give me the hope that will deliver me from fear and faint-heartedness." And from what we can tell from his writings, he was given hope. Hope gave him courage. And he was executed. And God did not come to save him. It's situations like this and circumstances in our own lives that loom before us with what seems like certain death, that makes us wonder if the divine has gone AWOL. But in Bonhoeffer's case, he stood for what was just and right and would not be compromised, and so in death won out over his opponents. For you, it might be exactly the opposite. Perhaps compromise may be what you are called to do. The important thing to remember is that, as followers of Jesus, we're called to stand on the side of life, not death. Love, not hate. Peace, not war. Hope, not cynicism. As a denomination, does United Methodism have the collective courage to embrace our LGBTQ brothers and sisters and put the division over homosexuality behind us? As a country, do we have the courage to face the scandal of systemic racism that has us more segregated and suspicious of one another than we were in the 1960s? As a culture, do we have the courage to stand against the fearmongers that continue to sow distrust of Muslims? You know, the Oxford Dictionary says that courage is facing danger without fear. Really? It sounds like denial to me. If we're honest, fear is a precondition of courage, right? Without fear, there's no incentive to be courageous. Like David, it just takes a bit of grit. In the words of that great theologian, Dale Carnegie, if you want to conquer fear, don't just sit home and think about it. Go out and get busy. That first day Ruby was in school, there was chaos. None of the white students came to school. However, on the second day, with no other white parents coming out in favor of civil rights or permitting their children to attend school, one white man broke the boycott and walked his 5-year-old daughter to school, past the gauntlet of curses and threats, and into a hostile environment where even the teachers were opposed to integration. Each day, father and daughter walked to school, not because it was going to garner national press coverage, which it did, but because it was the right thing to do. That man was the Reverend Lloyd Anderson Foreman, the local Methodist pastor, a man who decided to practice what he preached, even when it put his daughter Pam's and his own life at risk. What to be a fly on the wall when the Foremans were having that conversation with 5-year-old Pam. I mean, that's a whole nother level of courage from both Pam and from parents, yeah? Each day, they endured the derision and accusations of betrayal from the white mob. But a few days later, a few more white parents began bringing their children. Then a few more, and the protests began to subside. Don't let fear intimidate you into silence. Don't let the fearmongers scare you that the world is going to hell in a handbasket. We are called to be followers of Jesus, who showed us in his life and even in his death what it was like to stay true to our convictions. The time is long since past for us to stop being immobilized by our fears and, like David in our story today, have the confidence to run towards that which we fear. Without fear, there's no incentive to be courageous. And it's the courage that's important, not the outcome. The Bible tells me so. Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.fountains.org. wepuTloveFirst.org.